This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we are going to get right into the show today with two guests to talk about the upcoming Theodore Roosevelt Symposium. It is happening online September 23rd through the 25th, and you can get your tickets at theodorerooseveltcenter.org. We are joined now by phone from Iowa by Dwayne Junt. He is an historian and one of the presenters at this year's symposium. Dwayne, thanks so much for joining us today.
Sure, you bet.
And we also have humanities scholar Clay Jenkinson. Thank you for joining us today.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you.
So the theme is about Theodore Roosevelt's Western friends. Dwayne, I want to start with you. When we say Western friends, what do you mean?
Well, there's actually a few categories, I think, when you talk about Roosevelt and Western friends. I was just thinking about this recently when I was working on the preparations for my presentations, and when you talk about TR and his Western friends, you can basically sort of divide it up into three categories. You have the people who essentially were Easterners who lived in the East, but who had a really profound influence on TR's and actually the country's view of the West. People like the artist Frederick Remington, who was from New York, Owen Wister, who wrote the great Western novel, the Virginian, who was from Maryland, Gifford Pinchot, his chief forester, who was from Pennsylvania, John Burroughs, the naturalist from New York. These are all people who were Easterners and who lived in the East, but who had a really profound influence on how we view the West. And then you've got really the core group of people that Roosevelt knew in the Badlands in Medora, like Bill Seawall, Wilmot Dow, the Ferris brothers, Bill Merrifield, Mrs. Maddox, who made him his famous buckskin shirt. Those are sort of the Dakota Westerners. And then you've got the people who, you know, lived and spent most of their lives in the West, like Seth Bullock from South Dakota and William Allen White from Kansas. So there's kind of three groups, I would see it, of TR's Western friends.
And Clay, as one of the organizers of this event, we're going on 16 years now, but of course Theodore Roosevelt is a rich vein to mine here. There have been topics on Theodore Roosevelt, the adventurer, the naturalist, the president, the family man, and in more recent years, kind of an exploration of the people who most influenced him. Why did you want to go along that route of who is influencing a man like Theodore Roosevelt?
Well, partly, Ashley, we're selfish. You know, the Theodore Roosevelt Center is digitizing all of Roosevelt's papers, and we're trying to have a kind of encyclopedic understanding of his world. As you say, he's an immensely rich historical figure. He's a Renaissance man. He wrote 40 books. He read a book a day. He traveled on several continents. He knew five languages. He was arguably the best intellectually prepared president in American history, and that includes people like John Adams and John Quincy Adams and Thomas Jefferson. So we're trying to cover the range of possible Roosevelt associations. And, you know, we keep talking about Roosevelt in the Badlands, Roosevelt in the Elkhorn Ranch, mm-hmm. Roosevelt, your wife and his mother. We thought, what if we put on a larger lens and looked at Roosevelt's Western life? So he hunted in Colorado and in Arizona and Utah. He was able to attend the Hopi Snake dance, which was an enormous privilege for him. He gave speeches everywhere. And of course, he had that enormous influence on American conservation by setting aside 230 million acres of the public domain as national forest, national park, national monument, national wildlife refuge, national game preserve, and so on. So we thought, just as Dwayne has suggested, what if we looked at the key associations in the West and how all of that kind of burbled up to help create policy and Roosevelt's unique understanding of the West? As Dwayne says, he was one of the inventors of the idea of the frontier and the cowboy, and with Owen Wister and Frederick Remington, a certain nostalgia about this brief period that was fading. in frontier history. So this allows us to cast a bigger net this year.
Duane, as a student of history, what does that phrase that Clay just used, the idea of the frontier, mean to you?
Oh, boy. Well, I mean, I think in terms of just with Roosevelt, I mean, Roosevelt was so influential in sort of in his work, and I think sometimes that gets underplayed, how important Roosevelt was in kind of creating that idea that we still so much, when you think about the West, and you think about, I think, maybe first the landscapes and then the people who populated it. And when you think about the people who populated the West, probably the first thing that still comes to mind for so many Americans are cowboys and cattle, and then maybe after that, Indians or Native Americans. And Roosevelt was really influential in getting that idea fixed in the American mind, not only with his own books, Ranch Life and the Hunting Trail, Hunting Trips of a Ranch Man, The Wilderness Hunter, kind of this trilogy of books that he wrote about his time in Dakota, but then his friendship with Owen Wister, who wrote what many people consider to be the first and maybe still the greatest of all Westerns, The Virginian. And so I think Roosevelt was really, and that book, The Virginian, that Wister wrote, was dedicated to, of all people, Theodore Roosevelt. Mm. And Roosevelt has sort of, in a way, acted as an editor of that book and reviewed it for Wister. And I'm sure probably gave him, you know, recommendations and insights and commentary about what to include. And this is accurate. And this is right about the cowboy and so forth. So when I think about Roosevelt, I think about how much, you know, he contributed to that. And Frederick Remington, the great Western artist, did illustrations for some of Roosevelt's writings about the West as well.
Your talk, Duane, is called A Fine Posse Indeed. That sounds like a direct quote from Roosevelt somewhere.
Well, it sounds like it, but it's not. It's
okay.
Just something I crafted. To me, when I looked at this, when I started thinking about this topic, when Clay and Sharon Kilzer, the manager of the TR Center, approached me about doing this topic, and I was thinking, well, I know posse, you know, putting together this group of, you know, looking at a group of people that Roosevelt knew and that influenced him, and I thought, well, we have to use a Western term, so we have to use posse. And then it just seemed like this is a great phrase to kind of encapsulate this kind of a wide variety of people.
Right. I think, you know, the word advisor just doesn't conjure up an image
right.
that would fit
yeah.
someone like Seth Bullock. So let's talk about some of the people you will be mentioning. I'll start selfishly as a fan of the series of Deadwood. I've been to Deadwood, South Dakota a couple of times. Seth Bullock.
Yeah, Seth Bullock and Roosevelt were just very, very close. There's still sort of some confusion about when the two of them actually met, and their past and their relationship is a little bit kind of shrouded, I think, in some mystery and maybe some myth. And maybe the fact that both TR and Bullock may have exaggerated a little bit about the time that they shared together. But we do know that they met, we're pretty sure they met for the first time in 1892 when Roosevelt was acting as a U.S. Civil Service Commissioner and was doing a tour of Indian reservations in the Dakotas. That's probably the first time that they had met, and that's sort of what instigated their being friends. Bullock, like TR, also served in the Spanish-American War. He served in the cavalry, but in a different unit from Roosevelt. He had, not only did he serve as the sheriff of Deadwood, I think in 1870, but he also had a ranch near Belle Fouche, the S&B Ranch, that Roosevelt's children, actually, Roosevelt would send three of his sons out to South Dakota to spend time on a real Western ranch. T.R. wanted his children to have that kind of Western experience that he had had, and he sort of entrusted Bullock with that. Bullock, during his presidency, visited T.R. quite a bit in the White House when T.R. did what we sometimes call the Great Western Tour 14,000 miles, 25 states, 150 towns and cities in 1903. Bullock was along for most of that tour. And if you read T.R., especially the famous long letter that T.R. wrote to his Secretary of State, John Hay, about that trip, he talks about Bullock quite a bit and how entertaining Bullock was in giving stories and, you know, Western tales. And he was a frequent horseback riding companion of Roosevelt. He even provided some security and some muscle at one of T.R. stops in Butte, Montana, by sitting very prominently on stage and showing his revolvers hanging prominently from each of his hips. So, that last point's probably a little more in line with the Deadwood TV image.
Sure. Yeah, that, and of course, that is the most familiarity I have with him. Clay, I'm wondering, when you turn an eye towards organizing an event like this, do you weigh in on the speakers when, you know, it's one thing to find them and say, okay, this is a theme that we're looking at, and can you kind of flesh this out? But, you know, do you end up saying, okay, Ferris Brothers, yes, Mrs. Maddox, no, you know, that kind of thing?
Yes, to a certain degree, although we choose great presenters. And so you've heard, I mean, Duane has mastered this area, and not all of it was part of his previous research. So we knew he spoke to us before. We contacted him. We asked him to do this thing. Of course, he has enormous latitude to define it as he wants, but we talked it through, as we did with Jeremy Johnson, who's coming to talk about Buffalo Bill and the Newlands Reclamation Act, and also with Char Miller of Pomona College, who's coming to talk about the conservation posse that helped Roosevelt develop his conservation agenda and to nominate places, locations in the West to designate as national parks and national monuments. And of course, we have Timothy Egan as the keynote. And so we didn't dare suggest any topic to him except Roosevelt. And he'll do a magnificent job with that. But just, you know, one of the things that we so pride ourselves on, Ashley, is that these, and I think Duane can speak to this, these symposia wind up being sustained conversations. Mm. At so many events, you hear person A give a talk and then leave, and person B give a talk that's unrelated and then leave, and person C give a talk, and it's just like talk, and they don't speak to each other. But at our symposia, it winds up being a three-day discourse, a kind of running dialogue about certain ideas, and the scholars play off of each other, and usually on Saturday mornings we have a panel in which the audience gets to ask any old question they want, and sometimes there are even polite disagreements and so on. So we have a kind of well-deserved, I think, reputation for creating this sort of humanities conversation rather than a series of glittering lectures. And so I'm so looking forward to this, because this has really not been done before. This is a new area. You know, we think we know a lot about Roosevelt in the West, but to bring these people together, Posse 1 is the conservation posse. Posse 2 is these sort of like William Allen White down in Emporia, Kansas, who was a key political advisor to Roosevelt. Roosevelt wanted to hear what's going on in the West, and so he leaned on William Allen White to be a kind of a reality check from Eastern Kansas. And so that sort of synthetic approach, Ashley, is really what we love most. And Duane is a North Dakotan, so we love it even more.
When we talk about looking at a famous person from history, it can be very easy to whitewash over anything bad that a person did and just focus on the accomplishments. And I'm going to, you know, grossly oversimplify here things and say things like, okay, helped create a national park system, good. Attitude towards indigenous people, bad. How do the two of you work together to create this rich understanding of a person that we don't end up just excusing attitudes as, well, he was a man of his time?
Well, I don't know. You have to, as a historian, you have to, and especially when you study someone, you know, like Roosevelt, and Clay and I think, you know, both are both pretty easy to say that we're both admirers of Theodore Roosevelt, and it's to a certain degree, you know, love Theodore Roosevelt. When you spend as much time with a person as we have, you really get to know them. And when you really get to know them, you can't help but see them warts and all. So, and you know, Clay and I probably might disagree about what things that we, you know, don't like about Theodore. I mean, for me, I still, and for a lot of other people, I still have a hard time reconciling, you know, all of the hunting and all of the killing from the great conservationist, that they're, you know, even though Darren Lundy, who's spoken at one of our previous symposiums, you know, has made a good case that, you know, Roosevelt was sort of a frustrated museum naturalist, and you can understand his hunting from that way. When you read a lot of his writings, there's just this desire to kill wild animals that really sometimes is hard to square. I think the way that he treated William Howard Taft after he had basically selected Taft to be his successor, I think was not very good at all. And I sort of question, you know, how truly, you know, dedicated he was to being, you know, sustaining the Progressive Party after he became the Bull Moose candidate in 1912. The way that he treated some people who, you know, actually most people who opposed his view about World War One is not good. So when you study someone for so long, you read so much of their writings and their speeches and so forth, you're going to find things where you don't agree with them. But that doesn't mean then that you can't also appreciate the very, very, very many good things about him. And I think on the whole, Roosevelt was very, very good. And I would take exception maybe with the characterization of Roosevelt not his relations with Native Americans being really, you know, not good, or being, you know, antithetical to their needs and stuff. There's a very good book, Theodore Roosevelt and Six Friends of the Indians, that came out in 1997, that actually shows that, you know, Roosevelt, in fact, the author, William T. Hagen, argues that of all the 20th century presidents, Roosevelt's, you know, probably acted towards the tribes better than almost just any other president. And, you know, Clay had mentioned just a little bit ago his going to Arizona and seeing a Hopi snake dance. But later in life, Roosevelt, I think, really was starting to learn more and appreciate more, especially about Native culture. He got really interested in things like the dances, the pottery. If you go to Sagamore Hill, you can see lots of Native American crafts and so forth. And that's a really an area, I think, where more work and more study could be done. There's even though so much has been done on Roosevelt, you still can find these niches in these areas where we can learn more.
If you want to make the case that Roosevelt was an imperialist, you can. If you want to make the case that he was a warmonger or a racist or a bully or a political pugilist, or that he loved controversy. In fact, there's a book, Theodore Roosevelt on the Art of Controversy, and he just loved a good fight, or the shabby he treated first Taft, and then the savage way he treated Woodrow Wilson. There's plenty to add up that doesn't make sense to us entirely, and sometimes makes us cringe a little. But I agree with Duane that it's a very complex message. So you started actually by saying National Park Service good, Native Americans not so good. I'd add a third element to that. Many, as we now know, many of the national parks and other conservation properties were carved out of sovereign Indian lands, often without consultation with the native peoples. And there's a series of publications now, including a recent article in The Atlantic, saying give back parts of at least the national parks to the Native Americans from whose sovereign lands they were appropriated. It's a very complex thing. So on the one hand, there are some things for which there's no defense. We just have to say, wow, we'll just have to accept that as one of the warts of someone like Roosevelt. Then there are things where there's a kind of historical context that we need to understand, which at least makes us clearer about why he held such views. People really are men and women of their times, and they imbibe the zeitgeist of their time. And then there are areas where I think Roosevelt has been misunderstood. So, you know, he is an imperialist, to be sure, but he also won the Nobel Peace Prize for intervening in the Russo-Japanese War. he's a hunter, and I agree with Duane that at times it feels like way too much. And a paradox, on the other hand, he's a serious naturalist who provided specimens for the Smithsonian and the American Museum of Natural History and the Boone and Crockett Club, which he helped to create with George Bird Grinnell, America's first conservation organization, helped to save the bison and to help to save the pronghorn antelope and to demand sport hunting rather than game butchery, as Roosevelt put it. So we at the Roosevelt Center are trying to make it more complex, more nuanced, more rich, kind of a tapestry that you can't draw any simple conclusions from. But if you're looking for reasons to condemn Theodore Roosevelt, there are plenty. But the deeper you look into them, the less righteous I think you will feel.
Duane, why did you want to include William Allen White in your presentation on A Fine Posse Indeed, Theodore Roosevelt's Western Friends?
Well, part of it comes from my conversation with Clay and Sharon, and Clay rightly, you know, said, I really think we should talk about William Allen White, and he really is important, and he provides, you know, I think when you talk about Western friends or Western advisors, you think right away, oh, this is going to be, you know, sort of a stereotypical Westerner, someone like Seth Bullock, who owned a ranch and who had been a sheriff, and he kind of fits that mold. Oh, that's what a Westerner is. But White is a Westerner. He grew up in Kansas. He's a person of the plains, but he's a journalist and a novelist, and he provides kind of a different perspective. And he's nicely situated in Kansas and in eastern Kansas, so he's not in what we think of as the Mountain West or the Inner Mountain West. He's not out in Tombstone, Arizona, or someplace like that. He's in Kansas, so he's kind of on the margin between the Midwest. He's kind of at the intersection of the West, the Great Plains, and the Midwest. So he provides a real good perspective on that part of the West, where sort of the West is just beginning, because we, you know, I sort of used as my geographical, you know, what I had to decide, well, how do I, they gave me this topic, he's Western Friends, and I thought, well, I have to define that somehow. So basically I took the line starting with the Red River of the North in, you know, North Dakota, and took that line, the eastern boundary of North Dakota, South Dakota, Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas. And then I said, everything west of this line, that's what I will include, and that does include William Allen White. And he really was so important to Roosevelt in terms of giving him political advice. I mean, over the summer, I read, you know, at Clay's suggestion, I read the autobiography of William Allen White. And in that book, he doesn't talk very much at all about, you know, the advice that he gave Roosevelt during his presidency. He talks mostly about the Bull Moose campaign and the campaign of 1912 and the Progressive Party. And White was really influential in that. He's one of these prairie populists, you know, the reform-minded progressive populists, of which obviously that's a big part of North Dakota history. So he's really influential in that. It has a certain melancholy tone to it at times, because White sort of has this understanding that Roosevelt is sort of going on this fool's errand, you know, and there's this sense, and there's a great quote in it that I'm going to incorporate into my talk, where White basically says, you know, TTR in 1912 is going on this, you know, fool's errand, and he's going to hell, but I'm going to ride into hell with him.
He'd be a good adventurer to have on your side. Well, per usual, we are only able to scratch the surface on a topic like this, the 2021 Theodore Roosevelt Symposium, happening online September 23rd through the 25th. You can get your tickets at theodorerooseveltcenter.org. One of the presenters is Duane Junt. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And one of the organizers, Clay Jenkinson, thank you for joining us today.
My delight, and we also will be showing a tour of Roosevelt sites that we pre-recorded on video around North Dakota, including Chase Lake and Wild Horse Hill National Game Preserve. So we're going to show people some things they have never seen before.
Still to come on Main Street, a critical need for blood, plasma, and platelets. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A vice president at Sanford Health in Fargo says a growing number of unvaccinated COVID-19 patients have created a crisis for healthcare workers.
We really are in a crisis. Hospitals across the region are full with COVID and non-COVID patients.
Medical officer Dr. Doug Griffin believes the peak for hospital admissions is still weeks away. 90% or more of the patients in the hospital are unvaccinated. Griffin says Sanford is planning for another increase of patients by opening additional units, reducing surgeries, and reassigning some staff to critical care roles. But he says Sanford is also facing a critical shortage of nurses. He estimated the shortage is between 200 to 300 nurses in the Fargo region. North Dakota tribal leaders are asking the legislature's redistricting committee to create House sub-districts. They say this would give Native Americans more of a chance for representation in the legislature. Standing Rock Tribal Chairman Mike Faith suggested District 31, which now includes part of Mandan, southern Morton County, eastern Hedinger County, and Sioux and Grant counties, be split into two House sub-districts, one for Mandan and southern Morton, and the other for the rest of that district.
The purpose of the whole thing is representation and better communications for the Native nations within our state.
Matthew Campbell represents the Native American Rights Fund. He told the committee he's heard similar arguments from other North Dakota reservations.
They are certainly very interested in sub-districting for their districts to improve their opportunities for representation. I've heard that they are interested in being treated as communities of interest that should not be divided.
Campbell said he hopes the committee will engage with tribal leaders once it has a solid proposal for new district lines. The legislature will likely meet in special session in November to put the finishing touches on the district boundaries. And China is expecting its biggest corn harvest ever, but Midwest producers are not expecting that to decrease demand for imports from the U.S. Colin Waters is the director of exports and logistics at the Illinois Corn Growers Association. He says China's demand for corn has been increasing in recent years, so much so the country has all but depleted its strategic reserves.
I think that there's probably a pretty compelling argument to be made that those strategic reserves should be replenished. That may also kind of contribute to imports.
Waters says he doesn't expect China's bumper crop to affect Midwestern corn prices or exports, but the U.S. Department of Agriculture is projecting this year's corn harvest in the U.S. will be the second biggest ever. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Benedictine Health System, helping seniors live fully with independent housing, assisted living, long-term care, and rehab services in North Dakota and Minnesota. BHSHealth.org.
Hey, lifelong learner. Humanities North Dakota is featuring fear facer, speaker, and author Michelle Poehler live at the Bismarck Event Center. She has empowered thousands to step outside their comfort zone and tap into their full potential. Information and registration can be found at humanitiesnd.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is Jennifer Bradall. She is the regional director for Vitalant. This is an organization that supplies blood, plasma, and platelets to hospitals, and it sounds like we are in short supply of all of those. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with, of the three that I mentioned, and maybe there's one that I didn't mention, which one is the greatest need for our area?
The two that we're really struggling with right now is both type O blood, because that is the most transfused product, the most universal product that can be used by any blood type. So we're really in need of type O, and we also are in desperate need of platelets for cancer patients. And so those two are on the critical list for us right now that we're a little panicky about it.
Why do you say panicky? What is the level that we're at right now?
Basically, how it works is we typically have a commitment to hospitals on a regular basis. Over the years, we've kind of figured out how much they go through at this time of year and et cetera. So we have that on hand. And our levels are lower than that. And typically, we are a larger organization that works across the country. So if we didn't happen to have enough in Fargo or Bismarck, et cetera, we could see if there's more blood out in the communities in other parts of the country, New York or Chicago or whatever. But we prefer to supply our hospitals with our local patients, with local community members' blood, for a lot of different reasons. But that's something that we're really struggling with, is to get enough people through the door. Since schools and work has kind of gotten back to normal, it's really hit us really, really hard. And it's hard to explain, because I oversee a whole region where we're not seeing that in some of the other communities in the region. So hoping people will listen and step up and help us out, because it's really needed. And we're the only one that supplies most of the hospitals in North Dakota. So if you're not donating your plasma or red cells or platelets with Vitalant or with us, it's not being transfused into somebody's body in North Dakota, basically. So it's an educational piece, because a lot of people don't realize that. There are other places out there asking for donations, but they basically ship the product out of here. So we really need people to choose Vitalant.
Why is there such a focus on local if, like you said, other organizations are able to ship it?
Well, it's something that we usually in the past have always been able to take care of our own community. And we have been a lot of times the ones that have helped out other communities. When you think about Chicago, New York, California, they're not getting enough donors to meet their needs most of the time. And so that's where it's really a struggle to now be the one asking for help, when we're usually helping them. If we have anything left, we're sending that off to different hospitals. We don't want to be, I've actually met nurses and doctors that have had to have this conversation in children's hospitals in Texas, for example, where they have to have a conversation of, your child needs blood. And then there's that kind of panic look on the parent's face, like, oh, okay. And then they have to tell them they don't have it. You know, blood is a unique situation. It's not something that can be manufactured. It's not something that we can collect it all at the beginning of the year and be good for the year. There's a shelf life on it. And so it's a constant need. And I know we sound like we're constantly asking people to donate, but we constantly need that flow of donors coming through our door for that reason. And we don't want our doctors to have those kinds of conversations.
When it comes to an issue of a shortage, there is usually something like a vast increase in demand or a vast decrease in supply. Which is it in this case, or is it some of each?
We are definitely seeing a lot less donors coming through our centers in our communities, in Fargo, for example, and in Bismarck. We have local centers that people can come and donate and just walk in and donate, and we take you right away. It's just been really, really slow. So we're trying to pinpoint some of that as to what's causing it. Some of our smaller communities are really still giving blood drives and et cetera. They're doing their own and doing pretty well with them. But our local centers within Fargo and Bismarck are just really struggling.
And just those two areas? Because you oversee as far away as Denver, is that right?
Yeah, that is part of our division that we work with. And they're not having the struggles that we're having. So I'm boggled. I've been doing this since 2004, and I'm trying to figure it out. But that's where this is a great opportunity to educate people, let them know that everybody's welcome to come out and donate. We love to have first-time donors. When you come in, you can find out your blood type right away. That's something that's newer for us. And a lot of people are interested in having that. It's kind of nice to have your card in your billfold. If something were to happen, you would know what blood type you need right away. Rather than in an emergency situation, they would have to test you, et cetera. So, yeah, we are really looking to have people roll up their sleeve. It's not something that can be manufactured. It's not something that we can always say, oh, we'll count on somebody else to make sure the shelves are full. That's us. It's our community. It's our people that need to step up and make sure it's there, because you don't know when you're going to need it. And we don't want to be short on supply. If let's say a gal that was pregnant, and I knew this story has happened as well in another state, but she had some issues. And when she went to the hospital, they needed blood products and they didn't have enough. So nothing worse than somebody saying, yeah, we need 25 units of blood. We only have 20. Well, they needed 25. And so, you know, panic set in, and there was shipping of, you know, flying products in, and sheriffs doing what they had to do to get across the, you know, state to get them the products that they needed. And luckily that worked out. But you don't want to be that patient, or you don't want your family members or anybody to be in that situation where we're saying there's just not enough. We have to make a decision.
How often is it the case when somebody needs blood or platelets or plasma? Is it a case of immediate, we need it now, versus we know we're going to need this many over the course of a 6 weeks treatment or something?
For cancer patients, a lot of times we know a little bit more. They have a better idea of what that's going to look like. But for those emergency situations and pregnancies or childbirth, those are on the spot, we didn't see that coming type of thing. So we really have a unique system of making sure we're shuffling what we do have around to the hospitals that need it as quickly as possible as well. So it's a behind the scenes lot of work, but it's something that, you know, we have to work with what products we have and make sure that the patients that need it are getting it. So there's a lot of movement there.
You're listening to Main Street, and we are having a conversation today on a shortage of platelets, plasma, and blood. And we are visiting with Jennifer Bradall. She is the regional director of Vitalant, which supplies hospitals across this area with those items. And Jennifer, what kinds of considerations does a donor need to make? Do you have to be non-smoking, run a half marathon, only eat whole grains to be a donor?
That's a great question. A lot of people wonder if they do qualify to donate. And basically, what we are looking for is people that feel healthy and well. If you don't feel good and you're not feeling healthy and well, we really don't want you to come in. We would turn you away anyway if that's the question that was asked. But a lot of things have changed over the years. I was just talking to a fellow this morning that said he didn't think he qualified because he takes a certain medication. Mm. And the FDA changes those things on a regular basis and updates that. And little did he know that 6 years ago that changed. So you don't know if you can donate a lot of times. People used to think that, and it was the case, that if you had tattoos, you couldn't donate. Now you can. So there's a lot of changes that have happened. Even with COVID, there's no wait period after you've had the vaccine. People don't realize that as well. So yeah. There's a lot of different things. And there's a list of different questions that it's a pretty thick book that our donor care staff go through as far as if you have taken a certain medication or you have traveled to a certain part of the country. Different countries, they will ask those questions to make sure that we're supplying a safe blood supply.
Can you be someone who donates platelets, blood, and plasma? Because I donated a plasma back in college, and I remember them always saying, have you donated blood in the last, I think it was 2 months, and then you couldn't do plasma. Has that changed?
There is a rotation that you would need to do when you're donating blood and if you donate plasma at another location. The main thing with our donations, when you donate blood, we're able to take the plasma from it. So we're able to use that product right away. And that, again, is being used in hospitals locally. Platelets and red cells and plasma can all be derived from the same product. Okay. And so that's a lot of times it's based on your blood type. If we have a blood type that we know that we have enough of right now on the shelf, we will ask you to do the other service that we need, the product that we need. So if we really need platelets and you're not a type O blood, that might be what we're asking you to do that day. So it's really depending on the demand.
What is plasma?
It's kind of a coagulation product that can get the blood products to work together, basically. It's used in burn victims. It's used in different cancer patients. It's something that if there's a blood disorder, often people need the plasma derivatives to slow down the blood process or increase the blood process. So it really holds things together a little bit more. It's hard to explain, but it is something that is critical to a lot of patients that are entering our hospitals. It's about 7 out of 10 people that enter a hospital will need plasma, platelets, or red cells. So when you drive by the hospital, you can imagine how many people up there are using these products.
And is that 70%? That's the normal norm or that's a pandemic norm?
That's a normal norm.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I know during this pandemic that the compensation levels for plasma went through the roof. A lot of times you can be a donor, can be given $20, $50, maybe $70, $90 a week, something like that for donating plasma. And then especially if you were someone who had recently had COVID, those levels went up to hundreds of dollars at a time. And I even heard about one person who was making almost $1,000 a month donating plasma.
Yes.
What's happening there?
There's a difference between plasma centers and your local community blood center.
Okay.
The FDA does not allow us to pay donors to donate if we're transfusing a product into their body. For the safety of the blood supply, they don't want people to come in that aren't healthy and well, that may have different health issues, just to make the money, basically, when you think about it. So we're trying to do that up front to make sure that the product is as good as we can get without that concern. But they don't let us ask or pay money to the donors. Plasma centers are a for-profit organization, and basically what they do is they use those plasma products for testing other products or within a product itself. It's even used in makeup, some makeups. So it's all sold. So it's a for-profit business that companies will buy the plasma from the plasma centers. Ours is only given to hospitals. So there's the big difference.
Are you allowed to use that plasma if somebody else paid a person to donate it and there is an acute, critical need, could you go after that plasma that was purchased?
That's a in-depth look at what we can and can't do, because if it was drawn without the understanding that they weren't paid or they were paid, then it's a whole different deal. So that is something that it's not as easy as it sounds like it should be.
Yeah.
Once it's drawn in a certain way, and there's different requirements for that draw than there is for our plasma requirements from the FDA.
Okay.
So for the safety of the patient, typically they wouldn't do that.
What are the best ways for a donor interested in donating blood, plasma, platelets, in the idea that they want it kept locally and to hospitals instead of for-profit? What's the best way to reach out?
What they can do is they can go to Vitalant, VITALANT.org, and it's pretty simple. You just put in your zip code, and it'll show you the closest donation center or blood drive that might be in your community or neighborhood. And that's the easiest way to make that appointment. If they want to call, they can do it at 877-25-VITAL and make an appointment that way. And that's really what it just comes down to, a simple phone call. We'll get you in, have you come in. The process is very simple. Just to give you an idea what it looks like when you come to donate, the technicians will do a 10 to 15 minute questionnaire with you to make sure that you're healthy and well. It's kind of like getting a little mini physical every time you donate, which is another benefit that we could talk about. We've saved lives that way too. But getting that mini physical basically in 10 to 15 minutes, the blood draw itself only takes about 7 to 8 minutes. So it's a pretty quick draw. People are always kind of scared of that idea of sitting in a chair and donating for a long period of time. It's really not that big of a deal. When you think about 7 to 10 minutes to save up to 3 lives for every donation you do. And then after that, you have cookies and snacks on your way out the door. You wait for about 10, 15 minutes to make sure you're feeling healthy and well before you leave, and you're out the door. People usually say it's a lot simpler and wasn't painful, wasn't what they imagined it would be. So we just really want to try to get people in one time, because once they do it, they are realizing it's so comfortable to do and easy to do on a regular basis.
Is there a value to some of those organized community blood drives where you can have it at a hotel or at a school? Is that something that Vitalant coordinates with?
Yes. We spend about 70 to 80% of our staff go out and do mobile drives. Mm-hmm. So where we set up in a school, a business, a community. And we do that throughout North Dakota. Our small communities have been phenomenal at supporting our hospitals with blood. We actually get more product from small communities than we do from Fargo-Moorhead metro area, which is boggling to me as well.
More per capita or actually per
more
volume.
Like the volume.
Wow.
Yes. You know, and I think we've looked at it many times, and I think it's something where our small communities are very tight-knit. Mm-hmm. And when there's a blood drive in town, you show up. And if you don't, they're going to ask you on Sunday at church, where were you?
There's that.
And sometimes the gals will make homemade brownies and treats, and it's a social event.
Get that blood sugar back up afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. So there's always that social aspect of it, too, in the smaller communities, I think. But we are not seeing the turnouts like we'd like to see in our larger communities. And we really want Fargo to have that small town feel still where they know we can count on each other to help each other out. And that's exactly what this is.
If an organization is interested in doing that, what are the steps for hosting a community blood drive?
Oh, we would love to have more blood drives hosted within our communities. Fargo, we really need a lot more blood. So we would love to have small businesses, schools, challenge each other, whether they want to host a blood drive at their location or church. If they have a group that they are part of, you can do it at a location outside of Vitalant, or you can do a virtual blood drive where your members of your organization come in and donate on behalf of your organization in the local centers. So there's a couple different ways that we try to make it work for you and try to make it as easy as possible for people to come out and donate. So we'd love to hear from you if you can help us out. We'd love to have you call 877-25-VITAL, and we will talk to you about those blood drives and potential.
How many hospitals does Vitalant serve?
We serve in the division that I'm in. We serve over 70 different hospitals. So basically what we're doing is we're making sure that within our division, we take care of all of our local hospitals. If there's anything left before it expires, we are able to ship it to other locations that we work with throughout the country. Mm. So there's very little waste with our products. Some hospitals, very few nowadays, will draw their own product, and there's a lot of product wasted. So people come out and they donate, and then it's never even used. Mm. With our organization being as large as it is across the country, the nonprofit is able to send product, like I said, in between different locations and use it. So we have a very, very, very low expiration date.
Yeah, what is that expiration date? Will blood last a month, a year, a day?
Yeah, platelets is the big one where it's only 7 days. Wow. It's only good for 7 days. So that's why we need people to come in on a regular basis to donate platelets. With blood, it's a little different story. It's a 40 plus days that we can use that product. But once that 42 days hits, then we're done. We have to, you know, either discard of it or send it to another location. And most often we are able to get it to another location.
Jennifer Bradall is the regional director of Vitalant. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yes, this has been wonderful. Thank you for having the conversation.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Prairie Public is proud to be the media sponsor of the FM Visual Artists Studio Crawl, October 2nd and 3rd, noon to 6 p.m. See Fargo-Moorhead's artists at work, ask questions, and perhaps be inspired to create your own art. Find a map to begin your tour at prairiepublic.org.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 15th. North Dakota used to have a number of restrictions affecting Sunday activities. These are known as blue laws. During the 1917 legislative session, bills were introduced to relax those laws, proposing that movie theaters be allowed to open, baseball games could be played, and shooting and hunting would be permitted. But there were those who wanted to retain the blue laws, and another proposed bill would add a restriction, making it unlawful for any person to contribute or solicit money on the first day of the week for charity or other purposes. The senator who proposed the bill admitted it would prevent the passing of the collection plate on the Sabbath, but he felt the commercialization of the Sabbath should be prevented at any cost. While that bill didn't pass, neither did most of the proposals to relax the blue laws.
Baseball would be allowed on Sunday, but only if played in the afternoons and not within 500 feet of a church. The bill allowing movies did not pass, and the bill about hunting on Sundays passed the Senate, but not the House. Despite the law against hunting on Sunday, shooting was still a regular Sunday event. Even as the bill was being deliberated, the secretary of the Mandan Gun Club wrote in a letter to the Bismarck Tribune that 40,000 shooters and hunters are asking to have the law changed so that they will not be state criminals, as in the past. Many hunters likely gave the law little thought until Attorney General Langer announced renewed enforcement of the Sunday shooting law. Moreover, he claimed that the birding season, set to open on Sunday, September 16th, could not open before Monday, September 17th. The Fish and Game Board responded by saying, "We are inclined to believe that the bird season opens Sunday, September 16th, that the season chances to open on Sunday and that shooting is prohibited are matters for the state's attorneys and the sportsmen to consider." The state's chief game warden stated further, "Attorney General Langer's minions, the sheriffs and attorneys, must enforce the Sunday hunting ruling if he wants it enforced. Game wardens will enforce the general game and fish laws, but I am not instructing them to enforce Langer's ruling." On this date, sportsmen celebrated a state Supreme Court ruling that hunting on Sundays was admissible. Tune in tomorrow to hear the details. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When NASA unveiled the first images taken by the Hubble telescope, astronomers rejoiced.
It was like being at a rock concert. I mean, people were cheering.
Now a new telescope is set to lift off into space, and expectations are even higher.
Will Webb images look as gorgeous as Hubble images, right? Will we love them not just as scientifically valuable, but are they going to knock our socks off?
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Meet the ancient heroes of Ireland.
He was the greatest Celtic warrior of them all.
Visit the Holy Isle of Iona in the Scottish Hebrides.
It's a 10-minute ferry journey back in time.
And see what a DNA test can dig up about your family history.
Really, we are all part of the same family. We are all part of the human family tree.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, archaeological perspectives on warfare on the Great Plains. How did war change how people interact with the land around them? We'll visit with Dr. Andrew Clark, the chief archaeologist for the State Historical Society of North Dakota. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.